It hasn't spread out very far. It's very, very cold up there, so it's congealing the oil somewhat.
BP cleans up an oil spill on the North Slope. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 30th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a unique museum that displays ancient Alaska artifacts and more recent items.
It's not like a normal museum where everything has been collected. It's centuries old. There's no living tie to it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com. And by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
Forces are mobilizing to clean up an oil spill on the North Slope. An unknown quantity of oil, water, and natural gas escaped a ruptured 18-inch pipeline about a mile and a half from BP's Lisburn Production Center at Prudhoe Bay. The state's spill response manager, Scott Tiernman, says the cleanup of about 8,000 square feet of affected ground has been delayed.
They have held people away from the spill site itself to make sure that the area is safe. They've had air monitoring going on, and they're cleaning off the access road to the site to make sure it's safe to get out there. And then they'll be getting the spill response ramped up as quickly as possible.
6 to 10 response workers are expected to be on site by late today or early tomorrow. Tiernan says the state, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, and BP are coordinating on the cleanup plan. He says the spilled oil is concentrated near the pipeline that leaked.
It hasn't spread out very far. It's very, very cold up there, so it's congealing the oil somewhat. There was a road on the north side of the pipeline which prevented flow to the north, and it seems to be in a depression area which is preventing flow to the south area.
Tiernan says there's no gravel pad under the line, but that snow cover is protecting the tundra and will help responders scoop up the oil. He says the age of the pipeline is undetermined, and it's unclear what caused it to spring a leak. The pipeline was reportedly out of service when the spill was discovered during routine check early Sunday. As people in Western Alaska prepare for winter, one Alaskan has taken on the small goal of getting help to a community. So far, it's working in Nunum Iqua, thanks to the internet, and the state is also getting ready to respond if needed as the season develops. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Reports from rural Alaska indicate that residents are already having problems buying food and fuel for the coming winter. They're still waiting for a federal declaration of an economic disaster based on this year's poor commercial fishing season. The fall floods also destroyed boats and nets used for subsistence fishing for too many people across the region. Ann Strongheart helped organize a program last year that found a way for outsiders to help residents in the region. And this year, she says phone calls to people in Nunum Iqua found 22 of 23 households she talked to are having trouble again.
Out of the 23 families that I reached, 22 of those families said that they were already having problems with food and would like help again this year.
She has set up a one-on-one adopt-a-family program that connects people throughout the United States directly with families in Western Alaska, using the new mail flat-rate postal service to send food and supplies inexpensively. So far, in a little more than a week, she's gotten help for 14 of the 22 families that said they need it.
They contact me and they adopt a family. We've had several people who couldn't afford to adopt a family on their own, so I got permission from them to hook them up with similar individuals, and they're all adopting a family together. I have a group of 5 ladies right now spread across the lower 48 and Canada who are working together to adopt a family of 8, and they've already got 7 boxes of food and diapers and wipes ready to go and to send to this family in Nenam.
The state's also working with rural residents to prepare for the winter. John Moeller is the administration's rural affairs advisor. He hasn't gotten calls for urgent help this year, and he says supplies of food and fuel have been delivered to most places.
There's an economics issue here in terms of buying the commodities. But the other part of helping individuals, if you will, to afford fuel and heating fuel and food, as an example, is that those that qualify fully capitalize on the programs that are already out there, like the low-income heating assistance program, which in many cases regional nonprofits administer those programs and stuff. But, you know, food stamps, another example, to get as many people signed up for that that actually qualify so that offsets or puts a few more dollars in folks' pockets.
Specifically, in Nunamiqua, Moeller says of 156 people in the community, 116 have received food assistance. That includes food stamps, WIC, and other existing needs-based programs. Moeller says there's been a concentrated effort to make certain people know where the assistance is available and to put those systems on alert for the winter. He says if someone calls for help this year, the state will answer. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska is one of a handful of states in which pro-life organizers are working to revise legal attitudes toward the unborn. But as Ellen Lockyer reports, an Alaska backlash is brewing against the nationwide effort to legally declare unborn fetuses as legal persons.
Eagle River's Christopher Kirka has applied for and been granted the permission to begin the process of putting an initiative on the 2012 state ballot. Kirka's bill, extending legal person status to the pre-birth stages of human development, has been given the go-ahead by State Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell. In a letter to Kirka, Campbell states that the proposed bill meets state statutory requirements. But Vic Fisher, Alaska's elder statesman and a signer of the Alaska Constitution, says Kirka's initiative is not constitutional. Fisher and the Alaska Civil Liberties Union have filed a suit against Campbell, saying that the lieutenant governor should not have certified the initiative application and seeking to stop any further action by initiative sponsors.
We feel that the initiative is so improper in form as well as intent and substance that they shouldn't even be out there getting signatures.
Fisher says the initiative violates the state constitution.
And the attorney general issued a namby-pamby opinion saying this will not affect abortion. I consider this initiative to violate a number of provisions of the Alaska Constitution. It is designed for one purpose only, and that purpose is to stop women from exercising choice.
Attorney General Dan Sullivan has issued an opinion indicating that the initiative, if passed, would not lead to abortion being illegal in the state of Alaska. But opponents say if the initiative meets with voter approval, it could have far-reaching consequences. Meanwhile, the initiative sponsor, Christopher Kirker, when reached on his cell phone, says that signature gathering won't begin until next year.
We just got the booklets on November 5th, and we just started organizing circulators and collecting petitions. So we're probably going to have a kickoff campaign, or kickoff for the campaign in January, and then we'll be collecting signatures all of next year till November when we have our deadline, and then we'll probably get this on the ballot for the 2012 primary.
Kirka says he doesn't know much about the lawsuit against Campbell. He says earlier reports that the initiative is aimed at the 2010 ballot are false. According to Kirka, if passed, the initiative would give fetuses the same 14th Amendment rights under the U.S. Constitution as any other citizen. If a fetus's personhood is established, he says that fetus would be protected from deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process of the law. Opponents say if a fetus is granted personhood, that could entitle a fetus to a permanent fund check. Kirka must gather more than 32,000 signatures to get the initiative on the state ballot. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Black Friday shopping on Alaska style.
It's people grabbing things and pushing, and unfortunately not always behaviors we like. We like to have, this is a church, and like people to be respectful.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by the Alaska Engineering Fund, whose members include USKH Incorporated, a multidiscipline design firm offering architecture, engineering, planning, and environmental services. Information online at uskh.com.
Tucked into a corner of the first floor of the Wells Fargo Bank in Midtown Anchorage is the Alaska Heritage Museum. The collection was compiled by three generations of Rasmussen family members and is housed in the bank that was once owned by the family until the National Bank of Alaska was purchased by Wells Fargo and the collection stayed. Tom Bennett is the curator. He says there are more than 5,000 artifacts from all the Native cultures in Alaska.
Also 500 paintings, of which 70 are Sidney Lawrence. We have original drawings going back to the 1700s. We have, 150 watercolors, 700 or 800 original prints. From Alaskan artists. All of the stuff is from Alaskan artists or people who visited up here.
There are 80 sculptures, a collection of 30 caliber model 1895 rifles, and a wide array of traditional ivory carvings, and one unusual piece made from walrus ivory, an exact replica to scale of the Coast Guard cutter Bear. The Bear was an 1800s era vessel that sailed in the Arctic as a mail and cargo carrier. Working off original drawings from the Smithsonian Institute, the artist spent 8,000 hours crafting each piece by hand.
He did the entire thing in his basement, to the chagrin of his wife. Apparently he was buried down there for quite a while. And it's virtually all handcrafted. Even the inside shell and the hull pieces, the structure, were all handmade. Every single piece is made by hand by him.
Bennett says the collection has a lot of Alaska Native fans that stop by because they have personal connections to many of the artifacts.
Younger people and middle-aged people come in and say, oh, my father made that, my grandfather made that, and he taught me how to do this or whatever. We get it all the time, which is wonderful because it's not like a normal museum where everything has been collected. It's centuries old. There's no living tie to it. A lot of what's here is still very much tied to the people, to the children, to the cultures, to the families.
Why are you shy? It's a land.
Whoa. On this day, a group of young students visiting the museum are impressed by things they haven't seen before, like Sloan. He's 4 years old, and he really liked the Trading Post tokens.
The big coins, big circled coins.
Hmm. Were they different colors?
The same color, but some are different colors.
Most of the kids, like 4-year-old Lydia, agreed that the best part was the critters with tusks, or what seemed like really big teeth.
The walrus kids.
Curator Bennett says a man moving out of the state recently donated a tusk that he estimates is around 10,000 years old. Bennett's not yet sure if it's from a woolly mammoth or a mastodon.
My thought is that it's mastodon because it doesn't have such a long curl to it and because it's quite short. If it were mammoth, it would probably have a much more dramatic twist and turn to it.
It's 5.5 feet long, and Bennett says it will be a great addition because kids will be able to touch it, unlike the 13-foot, 250-pound mammoth tusk that is currently on display, but is off-limits to handling. He says another popular item is the walrus hide-covered kayak. Bennett says it's an excellent example of sewing and woodworking skills, and their durability made it possible for people to travel great distances in them, from the Aleutians to Northern California.
I know of some people who, as children, traveled from island to island out there inside these things. So they'd stuff the whole family in, and you had your station wagon to go. You know, pack the kids in, and okay, we're going off to visit family somewhere, and away they go. And the kids said they just had a blast. You know, it was just translucent enough on the inside to have light so they could play games and tease each other on the inside. And not only practical, but a lot of fun. family trip.
Jenny McCarty is assistant curator for the Alaska Heritage Museum. She has a degree in anthropology, and she came to Alaska from Canada to find Inupiaq relatives. McCarty wants to help preserve the old skills and art while also helping culture stay relevant by allowing it to grow into the future.
It is important to maintain traditions, but if people create new traditions and they help them to, helps to keep it going so that more people learn, then all the better for it, you know, because it's there and it's living. And just like, you know, language is living, it changes over time. Culture changes over time.
The Alaska Heritage Museum is free and open to the public during weekday afternoon hours. Pictures are at our website, aprn.org. The rich tradition of carving wooden masks in the Kodiak region is documented in a new exhibit catalog. The masks were collected by a Frenchman named Alphonse Pinart in 1871, who then donated them to a museum in France. In 2008, the Aleutic Museum in Kodiak collaborated on an exhibit with the French Museum, showing some of the masks in both locations. Now, a new catalog on the exhibit offers detailed photographs of all the masks and descriptions of their unique history. Aleutic Museum Executive Director Sven Hawkinson Jr. spearheaded the collaboration. He says Pinart gathered the masks on a long kayak trip.
He ended up kayaking from Unalaska to Kodiak, and then he spent the next 6 months until the spring of 1872 here in Kodiak. And in that time, he was documenting songs and stories, legends. He ended up collecting over 74 masks from Kodiak.
And he took them back to France.
He took them back to France with him, and he ended up donating them to the Chateau Musée in Boulogne-sur-Mer in 1875. When Pinart collected them, he actually did us a huge favor because, you know, between the tidal waves, earthquakes, and individuals who were afraid of them, we might not have ever had these masks to use and learn from.
You say afraid of them. Some individuals were afraid of the masks themselves?
Yeah, no. Growing up, we were always told if you ever came across a mask cave, never to touch them and to make sure to, you know, do nothing with them. I mean, it was just taboo.
When did you first see them, and what was that like?
I went over there with the hopes to negotiate a contract to have them come on an exhibit here in 2002, but that all fell through. And I ended up just being able to photograph some of them, see them, learn a little bit more. And from there, I was just like, okay, how can I get the masks back? And I subsequently was turned down several times from 2002 to 2006. And what I ended up doing was getting a grant and deciding, well, if we can't bring the masks to Kodiak to share with the people, well, let's figure out how we can get our artists and carvers over there. Because there's so few people who knew about the masks. And so we got a grant, took 10 artists over there in 2006 in June, and that was where the current director and staff realized the value and importance of these collections to us. And so they said, well, let's figure out how to work together. And then the deputy mayor, who has the yes, can say the yes, said, yes, let's make this happen. And so we started that process, and so in 2008, we were able to bring 35 masks over to the Aleutic Museum and Anchorage Museum to be exhibited. And out of that, we've got the catalog from the actual exhibit catalog, and then we did a full-size catalog, which is the Chinook Leica face.
What did the carvers that went with you from the Kodiak area, what did they learn? What did they come away with from seeing these masks up close?
Them seeing the masks for the first time, they didn't. Most of us didn't quite understand the sizes, and you know, like for example, the painted masks in the catalog you look at, you don't realize those are, you know, a quarter of what the original mask, the unpainted masks, are in size. And then the depth is the other important thing. when you see masks, just a front photograph, you can't really tell the depth of how deep the nose is, how deep the mouth is cut. And then when you're able to handle the mask, you actually turn the mask over and you look at how it's been hollowed out and that whole process where you would never learn from photographs.
Sven Håkansson Jr. is executive director of the Aleutic Museum in Kodiak. The book is available from the University of Alaska Press.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Help manage subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The deadline to apply is January the 8th. For more information, call 800-478-1456. This announcement is sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management.
Regional Council Lanun Una Nampakka Lagalugu 800-478-1456 Application at Humchikut January 8 Dami Una Kamukigun Khtuk U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management Anchorage Jamuk.
As millions of people pushed and shoved in department stores around the nation to buy the newest toys and gadgets, residents of Unalaska spent Black Friday clamoring for cast-offs at a church garage sale. KUCB's Ann Hillman checked out the goods.
Dozens of people filled the entryway to the United Methodist Church on Friday morning. You could hear multiple languages spoken as you waited for your chance to enter the mega garage sale.
It's like a Black Friday sale down south if you've ever been there. It's people grabbing things and pushing and unfortunately not always behaviors we like. We like to have, this is a church and like people to be respectful, and there's always plenty to go around.
Becky Sheffield coordinates the quarterly sale. The church began hosting them about 4 years ago. None of the items are priced. Everything is for donation only. Sheffield says they chose the day after Thanksgiving because she missed going to the Black Friday sales down south.
Puts us a little bit in the real world.
She says the sale also gives community members a chance to see the widest variety of goods on the island. Rows of tables spilled over with things. Shoppers filled the church sanctuary and stuffed bags full of clothing, household goods, costumes, games, books, even small appliances.
Oh, I got a microwave this time and one printer.
Jolly Agaoli is sending a microwave back to his family in the Philippines. Normally, he sends bags of clothing, too.
You can take a look what you want and just donate it a little bit. And that's more, it can help to my friends and relatives.
Others have mailed back dozens of water bottles for students and other basic supplies. Julianne Tucker says the donation-only sale also helps community members living in Unalaska.
No, this is just really unique for the community because when I first moved back here with Carmen and she was only 6 months old, we had no money, no job. And I walked in here and I got clothes, utensils, bedding, everything that we needed. And it was really, really nice. So it's a great amenity to the community.
But if you're looking for something specific, you might want to arrive early and, as Dee Dee Hinton suggests, have a strategy.
Well, if you can come in the day before and just like drop off something, then that gives you a chance to kind of look over the tables the day before you even come in. Then that way you already know where you're going and you could go straight in, grab it. You already know what size it is and just grab it and go. Because it's just impossible to just stand around and be able to look through everything because everyone else is looking through the same stuff.
But for some, like Vic Fisher, the sale didn't quite fill the need for Black Friday spending.
I'm going to go home, going back to getting on the internet and doing my Black Friday shopping.
The Second Blessing Sale is hosted by the Unalaska United Methodist Church as a way to get affordable goods to community members and to recycle items and keep them out of the landfill. Anything left over after the sale is donated to other nonprofits. The next will be in March. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Plenty of people in Sitka also hit the streets to shop on Friday, in part because of a sales tax holiday. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
As far as we know, there were no long lines of people waiting for Sitka stores to open in the early morning darkness on Friday. No stampedes of agitated shoppers grabbing for merchandise at low, low prices. No ads spelling crazy with the K. But there were plenty of shoppers out on Friday, the first of a 2-day reprieve on paying sales taxes in Sitka. One of those shoppers was Adrian Altman, who was making her way down Lincoln Street around 11 in the morning.
We just moved here from Florida, so I bought a bunch of Alaska stuff to send home to everybody. Everyone's getting Alaska stuff.
Off I go to Stereo North at the corner of Lincoln and Harbor Drive. It's one of the places in town where you can get a TV, among other big-ticket items. Owner Shirley Robards is organizing some rock and roll CDs when I walk up to her. She says when you average out the people who aren't shopping earlier in the week with the people who are shopping during the sales tax holiday, the store ends up doing a little better than normal, but it's not a make-or-break event for the business.
Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, you know, they're coming in and looking and looking. So, but last year was excellent. This year it started out so far so good. Yeah, and they buy big-ticket items because they save $50.
The Sitka Chamber of Commerce is among those hoping the sales tax holiday pays off. Executive Director Sheila Finkenbinder lobbied hard in late October for approval of the holiday. She told the Sitka Assembly that it will encourage residents to spend money locally rather than on the internet or in other communities. On the flip side of that, the holiday means that city government loses 2 days of sales tax revenue during a year when that money already has fallen short of expectations. Second quarter sales tax receipts were down about 14% from the same period a year ago, and third quarter sales tax receipts were down more than 21% from the same quarter a year ago. Still, Mayor Scott McAdams was among those supporting the tax holiday, and on Friday was among those taking advantage of it.
I really think that on the consumer side, we've got a lot of folks that are working hard in this town, trying to make ends meet, and just a little bit of support from the city during the holiday season, I think, is the right thing to do.
And you're out looking today yourself?
I am. We're out shopping. We're looking, me and my son Gavin are looking for gifts for Mom.
Sorry, Mom. Can't tell you any more than that. This is Ed Ronco reporting in Sitka.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. And by
Cook Inlet Keeper. The Muckrakers Ball is Saturday, December 5th at 7 p.m. at Anchorage Rum Runners. Jeannie Devin will be recognized for her blog, The Mudflats. Information online at inletkeeper.org.
The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. If you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.